In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
It goes without saying that 2022 is a pivotal year for America, because the elections mean you are giving someone else legal power over your life, power to insert their beliefs between you and your children. And although it shouldn't be so, as we saw in the pandemic, you're giving someone else power over your churches, even deciding whether or not you have free speech. So the question is, do you want to give power to people who will take away your rights, see the aforementioned pandemic, or give power to people who will protect your rights even during a pandemic? It's during crises, during emergencies, when people's true beliefs shine through, especially people who have been elected. How will they use the power you gave them? Blue states used the pandemic to enforce their will on people. Don't think for a moment that they didn't want to go even further than they did. Red states used more caution and largely left decisions up to local control and to individuals, especially after the initial wave of panic passed, when it became clear that COVID was not the Black Death mini-Hitler Dr. Falsely and his media minions were making it out to be. 2022 will be a pivotal year, and if you thought the explosions coming from the left are winding down, oh, we haven't seen anything yet. And not just at the elected level, but in corporations and organizations, more is coming. Politically, until they are stopped, the left will continue to vote themselves billions more taxpayer dollars because they need marketing funds to convince you of their delusions. They will continue to use their current hold on government to try to sabotage their political opponents, which is why the Biden administration just launched their Orwellian Ministry of Truth. They will continue to use the media to lie, to manipulate, and to cover their tracks because the last thing they want is sunshine. And if you want the right people to win in November, it means getting it right in the primary, when you help to decide who has the best chance to beat the other side in the general. You've got a lot of power this year, if you use it, and use it wisely. He is the former president of Promise Keepers, the former head of a major political party, the Republican Party, and is currently of counsel for the James Madison Center for Free Speech, and now he is running for position 3 on the Oregon Court of Appeals, a statewide nonpartisan position. I'd like to welcome Vance Day to the show. Vance, it's great to talk to you.
Oh, it's great to be with you. I love the show. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much. So let's start with the position that you're running for. What exactly is a judge of the appeals court, and what do they do?
Well, in Oregon, there are three levels of courts. So you got the circuit court, which is the trial court, about 180 judges across 26 districts here in Oregon. And then right above that, there are 13 judges that make up the Court of Appeals. And I always argue that the Court of Appeals is really the most powerful court in Oregon. It affects every Oregonian's life every single day. Now, right above the Court of Appeals is the Oregon Supreme Court. And of course, you know, everybody hears about the Supreme Court. But what really happens in Oregon is all of the appeals, 99.9% of them, go to the Court of Appeals. So when you knock on that court's door, they have to answer. They don't have any discretion to say, go away, we don't want to hear you. So all of the appeals go there first, except just a couple. And then once the Court of Appeals makes a ruling or an opinion, you can appeal to the Oregon Supreme Court, but they don't have to take it. So you knock on their door, they can go tell you to pound sand because they really only take about 15 to 20% of the appeals. So really what that means is that 80% of the cases end at the Court of Appeals.
Wow.
I mean, let me give you an example. So a couple weeks ago, there was a decision by the Court of Appeals which removed or reversed a jury verdict for the people of Oregon for $1.1 billion. That's billion with a B. And it had to do over, you know, the state of Oregon mismanaging forests. And I have to be careful because this case could come back. And when I win a seat on the Court of Appeals, it may come before me. So I can't give you my thoughts on it, but I can tell you, you know, here's a court that is so powerful that it reversed a $1 billion verdict and said, nope, it didn't, you guys didn't do it right. So that's how the court system works in Oregon. And it's very, very important that the citizens understand that when they vote.
Oh, absolutely. In your candidacy announcement, you said this: our Constitution made a promise to us as Oregonians that we would do justice, that we would respect others, that we would live in a diverse community and not have a government that bullied us. As a former circuit court judge, I know how to work within the judiciary to bring about change. You know, when a lot of times we hear change, that often means activist judges, and I don't think that's what you meant. So what kind of change were you referring to there?
Well, we got to change how the culture works in the judiciary so that they respect the Oregon Constitution and the rule of law. In my opinion, there are some judges who view the Oregon Constitution and the United States Constitution as some, I guess, legal etch-a-sketch. You know, those things when you were young that you could just slip over and turn back and then draw whatever you want on it. You know, they view the Oregon Constitution as almost like an elastic form of law that they can stretch over any policy, anything they want. Hmm. No, that's not how it works. The Constitution is, it's not a contract, it's a covenant, because it impacts generations yet unborn. Hmm. And we bind those future generations through the Constitution. And it is the measuring stick upon which we view all legislation, all administrative rules, everything that happens in the civil government. See, people have forgotten that the basis of a republic is self-government.
Right.
You can't have, you know, a vibrant republic, a constitutional republic, if you don't have people who self-govern. And so what that means is that the civil government has to respect individual government, family government, church government, business government, because there really are five forms of government. And so when I say we got to change, we got to move forward and in essence return to a respect that for the other forms of government, for the liberties that come from our Creator. Because our inalienable rights don't come from government. They come from our Creator. And so I think there are a lot of Oregonians out there who are, I don't know, shall we say, cranky, and they should be, about how the civil government just overreached into their lives this pandemic.
Absolutely. Real quick, on your campaign site, you talk about your opponent who has been on the Court of Appeals since the early 2000s, and that, quote, positions on the Court of Appeal were never meant to be lifetime tenured positions, but all too often they turn out that way. And so I don't think we really want term limits, but overall, should it be somehow easier to remove judges or encourage them to move along? For example, I've often thought that maybe we need something along the lines of three strikes for judges. They get removed if they have three appeals overruled on constitutional grounds, and that could be a disqualifier because clearly they're not ruling in favor of the Constitution, or at least they don't seem to know it very well. So what are your thoughts in terms of maybe not having these lifetime tenured positions?
Well, that's I've never heard anybody suggest that. I kind of like that. Three strikes and you're out for the judiciary. You know, I am disturbed by how many judges that I've worked with don't have any real understanding of history, of the context of the Constitution, of really what inalienable rights means. And worse yet, there are some judges, I mean, when you're a trial judge, a circuit court judge like I was for 7 years, your job is to manage trials. And trials are really important things. You mess those things up, it destroys lives.
Right.
Yet some of the judges that the governor and other governors have appointed, before they took the bench, they never even tried a case. Hmm. I mean, think about that. You're getting judges who are being picked for because they fit a category, or they're friends of the governor, or they own something. I don't know. That's why elections are so important. The Oregon Constitution
absolutely
requires, you know, every judge to run for a 6-year term. The problem is that there's kind of this little deal in my mind where the judges understand that if they've got somebody who's politically like them, like a Democrat in the governorship, like we've had for almost 40 years,
right.
If you retire in the fifth year of your six-year term, who gets to fill that open slot? The governor. And he or she is going to pick somebody who's politically like them.
Yeah, and then that just leads to, unfortunately, legal groupthink. We are up against the clock coming up. Vance Day was a victim of the woke before they were even known as the woke. Stay with us. We'll talk about that next. And welcome back. This is the I Spy Radio Show. We're talking today with Vance Day, who is running for a judge on the Oregon Court of Appeals, Position 3, against an incumbent. And Vance, for people who don't know, you were a victim of the woke crowd before there really was such a term. And this is from your campaign website, teamvanceday.org. Quote, in 2014, Judge Day, based on his deeply held Christian convictions, quietly recused himself from a non-judicial duty, marrying same-sex couples, a decision that in no way prevented same-sex couples from getting married. As a result, left-wing progressives launched a vicious but unsuccessful attack to drive him from the bench, cancel his law license, strip him of his possessions, ruin his reputation, and even have him imprisoned. And then, according to an Oregonian article, you have said that the real reason behind your suspension was your religious opposition to gay marriage and that you refused to marry same-sex couples. So, is that correct? And did the Supreme Court actually remove you, or didn't they?
Yeah, they suspended me for the last 8 months of my six-year elected term, a total of 3 years. They said I couldn't run for judge or be a judge and all that kind of stuff. It really was a jihad against my liberty of conscience. Mm-hmm. You know, every person has a liberty of conscience. And if your liberty of conscience is not tied to an objective standard, and mine is, it's God's word, the Bible, as a believing Christian, I have to have a standard. And so when the government comes to you and says, you have to celebrate this aspect of our new, you know, view of marriage, I said no, gently, kindly, but no, you know. And then they said essentially, well, then we're going to file these complaints against you and you're going to go through an ethics trial. So you just better resign. And frankly, I said no again. I think I actually told them to go self-propagate, but you know, they didn't like that, obviously. And nobody really ever fought against the Judicial Fitness Commission, the ethics board for judges. So I stepped into the battle and never expected it to last 3.5-4 years. My legal bills were over $1 million. Wow. And it ended up in an indictment for crimes that never happened, you know. And so it reminded me that the governmental elites who believe, they strongly believe that they know what's best for everybody. And when you cross them, they will crush you.
Yeah.
Well, I think Oregonians are waking up to the fact that the governmental elites don't know everything, and we don't need them telling us how to live, work, play, who to live, you know, spend time with, and how whatever we need to put into our body to stop this pandemic. That's not their job.
Right, right. So, I think that was a prime example, you know, of it. So you didn't want to officiate a same-sex marriage. Isn't this essentially the same situation that the United States Supreme Court ruled on and said a cake maker could refuse to make a cake for a same-sex wedding? I mean, has the Oregon Supreme Court ever apologized for getting it wrong, terminating you for your religious beliefs, or suspending you anyway?
No. No, in fact, they even went a step further, and I'll criticize them at this point, which undoubtedly will end up in an ethics complaint at some point in the future, I promise you, because that's how they work. The Oregon Supreme Court actually issued their opinion, a 92-page opinion that essentially concluded that I was less than forthcoming, I think was the word they used, something like that, in some of my testimony. Okay, so they did that. But the question is, why did they do it 3 weeks before, or 30 days before my criminal trial, where I'm facing time in prison on the single issue of, are you going to believe Judge Day about whether he gave a gun to a veteran and Judge Day's witnesses, or the one person the veteran who was a felon. You know, when the Supreme Court of the state of Oregon issues an opinion which has no timeline, no time requirements, 30 days before my trial, on the single issue that a jury in a criminal trial has to decide, there's something nefarious about that.
Yeah, sure sounds Think to me like they're that. Trying to influence that.
Yeah, put their heavy thumb. I mean, there were editorials that said, whatever you think about Judge Day is immaterial. But for the Oregon Supreme Court to put their thumb on the scale of justice and try to influence it, that's wrong.
Right, right.
And so that's one of the reasons I'm running for the Oregon Court of Appeals, to kind of straighten that out. You know, Oregonians need a constitutionalist, a person of faith, on the Court of Appeals, because there are none. And I probably will end up being, frankly, the dissenter in chief, which is just fine with me.
Yeah. Well, also, I think this is from your website. It says that if elected, you would be the only strict constructionist on the Court of Appeals. Like the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, strict constructionists believe that judges should be faithful to the Constitution and laws as written and apply them. So the question is why aren't there more judges like that? I mean, if the Constitution is the highest law of the land, shouldn't they all be strict constructionists?
Well, I think so. But my starting point is different than a lot of other judges' starting point. And I've always been taught that your starting point guarantees your outcome. So, for example, my starting point with regard to the metaphysical world, how we got here, is I have a creator. He made me. He designed me for a purpose, and therefore I have meaning. I have a destiny. That's a very different starting point than if you believe that there is no creator, that you're just a product of time and slime, a cosmic accident. Therefore, you have no purpose. You have no meaning. You have no destiny. So really all there is in your life is an accumulation of power, which you get to use to, you know, enforce what you think is right, because there is no right or wrong if you don't have a creator.
Yeah.
So a lot of judges start from that starting point, and therefore they are pulled into the, I want more power, and I know what's best for society. No matter what the law really says, I'm going to insert my opinion, my view of policy, how I think things should be. And our Constitution isn't designed to allow the judiciary to do that,
no,
really.
No,
that's why I'm a strict constructionist.
It's not. And this notion that there's no creator and they know what's best for society, I hate to say it, but that's exactly what led to the eugenics movement in the early 1900s. So, all right, everybody stay with us. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the hot topic, abortion. And welcome back. We're talking today with Vance Day. He's running for judge on the Oregon Court of Appeals, Position 3. And Vance, in this segment, the whole week has been consumed with the topic of abortion. And have you had a chance to read the draft opinion? And if so, what were your thoughts?
Well, I haven't, and I didn't read it on purpose, and here's why. In Oregon, there's the Oregon Code of Judicial Conduct, which, as a candidate for a judicial position, I have to obey. And one of the things that it doesn't allow me to do is pronounce or give any indication. That's maybe a little hard. It doesn't allow me to tell people where I stand on certain issues, because that issue could come in front of me. And so let's say that a Second Amendment issue or a business freedom issue or pro-life issues, pro-choice issues, whichever side you're on, come before me as a Court of Appeals judge. If I talk about that on your radio show to a certain extent, then I get pulled out of that case. I can't participate in it. That's how the rules work. But here's what I can say. People ask me all the time, you know, where do you stand on the Second Amendment? How would you rule if, you know, blah, blah, blah? And I tell them I can't answer that question, but I can tell them about my experience and my background. And I usually tell them that I've been a hunter since I was 7 years old. I have a concealed handgun permit. I know how to use weapons. I'm a very good shot. And like other judges, I've received awards, one of them being the Second Amendment Award. So they can draw their own conclusion about where I stand on that issue. But it disturbs me, you know, that here we have the United States Supreme Court, and somebody decides to release a draft opinion, because draft opinions change.
Sure.
And we have to ask the question, why did they do that? Well, they're trying to weaponize the political environment against the conservatives on the Supreme Court. They're trying to cancel the thought processes of those conservatives, find a weak one, and in the next few weeks, as this draft opinion is becoming final, to tap it down or maybe push one or two of them to not agree with it. I don't think that's going to work. But that's how nefarious those are in, frankly, the left, the socialist Marxist movement in America. The ends justify the means, and they will do anything to accomplish their will.
Absolutely. And in fact, we've had these leftist organizations in the last couple of days have put out the call to their followers, along with the addresses, the physical addresses of these justices' homes. And right now, these members of the Supreme Court, I think, are in more real, genuine danger than any of the congressmen ever were back on January 6th of 2021. I mean, they have people surrounding their homes now.
Sickening, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
But you know, and well, let's take an example that's closer to home. You know, all of us, to a certain extent, were disturbed by what happened in Portland. You know, 110 days of riots. Mm-hmm. I call them riots because that's what they were.
Absolutely.
Some people called them, you know, First
Peaceful
Amendment
protests.
Well, yeah. Yeah, that's not peaceful when you're trying to burn down the federal courthouse. And so you know, we must remain under the rule of law, not the rule of experts and elites. The rule of law says, and the concept means, that we apply the law to all people at all times, in all places, in the same manner. And so when Oregonians see that the DA of Multnomah County and the mayor, Ted Wheeler, didn't, you know, push to arrest those members of the riots, very few of them were arrested, and very, very few, I can't even think of any that were really prosecuted. They know that the rule of law now is unequal, that under the equity doctrine, not the equality doctrine, but the equity doctrine, we're going to let these people go because they kind of fit what we think, you know, politics should be. They're kind of on our side, so we won't throw the book at them. Oh, but if you're a conservative and you tried to, you know, do the same thing, you'd be in prison for the rest of your life.
Oh, absolutely.
And what that does is it removes the sense from the public that the judiciary will have a balanced scale, that you will be innocent until proven guilty, that they will respect your rights and treat you just like anybody else.
Yeah, or the notion that justice is blind. Mm-hmm. As long as you're registered Democrat, you're treated very differently in the court cases. Although there are only 9 justices, the Supreme Court is still an organization, and any organization needs trust to operate because they've got their law clerks and there's other people behind them. So clearly this leak damages that trust, and I think at least two judges have said that exact thing. So if something like this were to happen at Oregon's Court of Appeals, this massive breach of trust, and if you were put in charge of dealing with that kind of leak and that breach of trust, how would you handle this?
I'd probably handle it very similar to the Chief Justice Roberts and how he did. He said, yes, this happened. It does damage the how we function. And number two, here, we're going to go ahead and investigate. I'm assigning the U.S. Marshals to do that. Now, the key is he has to follow up. And they should be able to. They'd have a system, and they'll find out who leaked it. And if it's one of the justices that he or she okayed that, then Congress should impeach that justice, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. That justice should be removed. And then if it's a law clerk, somebody on the staff, then they should be fired. And if there's a criminal statute that applies to that type of activity, then they need to be prosecuted. And if they're a lawyer, then they need to be disbarred. Because, you know, my grandma used to say, you know, Sonny, you plant corn, you don't get rutabagas. And she was describing the law of reciprocity, the what you sow, you will reap. Oh, and so,
absolutely, very, very biblical for sure. So, unfortunately, we are up against the clock with you. His website is teamvanceday.org. That's teamvanceday.org. And we're going to link that up on iSpotRadio.com on today's show page. Vance, all the best in the election ahead. Sounds like we truly need you there.
Well, thank you. May 17th, it ends. So go to the polls.
I'd like to welcome Scott Shepherd back to the show. He is a fellow at the National Center for Public Policy and is the deputy director of the National Center's Free Enterprise Project. Scott, it's great to talk to you again. Welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me, Mark. Always great to talk to you as well.
Yeah, so you're also an attorney, and we had just interviewed Vance Day, who is running for the Oregon Court of Appeals, a statewide nonpartisan position, but you're also a voter. So what do you as an attorney look for in a candidate for a judge position?
Well, I mean, these days, what I want to know is that the judge is going to apply the law. Too often we're seeing judges that, I mean, it's sort of the famous Hawaii judge who put a stay on anything that the Trump administration tried to do,
right.
and happy to wave through anything if it's from a liberal administration. What I want is a judge who's just going to apply the law and, you know, do so with compassion in sentencing and those kind of considerations, but also with the wisdom to realize that criminals thrown back on the streets are destroying Portland and destroying a lot of other important cities. And so they'll be wise and kind, firm and fair, but always in absolute adherence to the law and not making things up as they go along because of their personal policy preferences.
Yeah, applying the law is certainly a rarity nowadays in Oregon. The other big news this week is abortion. And I was wondering if you had a quick opinion either on the draft opinion and or on the leaker.
Well, you know, a couple of, I think the leaker has to be found and disbarred. That has to be the end of this person's career. That's that's never happened before.
Mm-mm.
It's the Supreme Court has come out with a lot of astonishing decisions over the year, but they've never, ever leaked. This has to be, it has to be dealt with or the court is cratered, is ruptured. Now, that being said, I don't understand. I'm presuming that the leaker was a law clerk for one of the liberal justices. And, you know, the idea was to rally the side. But I'd love to know the thought process that got them to leaking early, because aside from the breach of trust and aside from the fact that it now, instead of being a decision of the court, it has this taint surrounding it. If the goal was to scare Kavanaugh or someone to siding to keep Roe, this strikes me that it's now impossible for anybody of good faith to switch their position because they look like they're backing down to a mob.
Right.
And if the goal was to rally the left for November, well, this is two more months for this to become old news by November.
Yes, I've thought that exact same thing.
You know, in 2000, I think George Bush would have won by 3 or 4 points and we wouldn't have had to go through Florida, except that DUI information came out the Thursday afternoon or Friday afternoon before election day.
Right.
If this had come out then, it might have kept a lot of particularly middle-class moms at home instead of drifting to the right, as they're definitely so many of them are going to do because of the lunacy and the inflation and all of these other events. But if this percolates for 6 months and it turns out suddenly nobody's having to turn to what was it, back alleys and coat hangers,
those the
phrases
the
of the 70s and 80s? Well, if that doesn't happen, then this has disappeared and everybody's going to be focused back on the fact that interest rates have galloped up to 8% and inflation is at 11% and the misery index will be discussed a whole lot more than other artifacts of 70s of politics.
Right.
So I think it backfires in every conceivable way for whoever leaked.
Yep, I agree with that. And, you know, I ask about abortion because the Free Enterprise Project, you guys are pushing back against woke ideology. And now with this abortion situation, the woke are going to go even more woke. And major corporations, though, are now saying that they will pay people to kill their babies, an all-expense-paid trip from red states where they can't get unfettered abortion and pay them to go off to a death destination state. I mean, what a horrible situation where killing babies is now part of a company's employee health plan.
It really is a stunt. I don't mean to laugh, but it's so ghastly.
It is.
That it wraps around to be sort of mordantly funny because... And they gave a lot of thought to it because I was looking into this at Amazon yesterday for a piece that I'm writing, and Amazon didn't just say, oh, well, this is just for abortion, because that would have put them in the Disney position. They just said, well, and everybody knew what they were doing, but they wrapped it up with a bunch of other health benefit extensions for non-threatening travel, for non-threatening procedures. And non-life-threatening procedures, although, you know, the irony of calling that a non-life-threatening procedure. They wrapped it up so it won't be easy to attack legally. But it means that the legal departments of these companies are putting an awful lot of energy into just always bouncing up and down on the left-hand side, the far left-hand side of American politics, in ways that expose them to a lot of potential future shareholder litigation, legislation. They've ticked off the party that used to protect corporations and business, and now they don't have any protectors, and I think they're going to reap the whirlwind, as Bob Chapek and Disney are reaping the whirlwind. So there's a lot to watch these days.
Oh, absolutely. You mentioned Amazon is doing this. You've also got Citigroup. There was an article about them, I think, last week saying that they would pay for these abortion trips. You've got Yelp and Uber and Lyft, Bumble, Match Group, Salesforce, and even Levi Strauss among these groups. But, I mean, what do you think is going to be the long-term impact of this? Do you think employees will really want to work for what essentially becomes a pro-death company? I mean, could that backfire? And what can shareholders do?
Well, it can backfire in all sorts of ways. I mean, France has, most of Europe has abortion laws that look a lot like what most American states will end up with, something that allows abortion for a while and then doesn't allow it. And there's no late-term abortions in Europe. But somehow Amazon's French workers aren't being flown over here. And somehow, you know, you go back to the election stuff, somehow Georgia was attacked for election laws that still weren't as restrictive as New York and Delaware. They were fine because they were blue states. This patently partisan behavior is setting these companies up for lawsuits, shareholder derivative lawsuits that directors are acting for their personal policy preferences, self-dealing rather than acting for shareholders, all sorts of other potential, as we were saying, litigation, legislation. And so there's a lot that shareholders can do, and there's a lot that that companies are going to have to defend if they keep picking sides.
Right,
so
right.
Obviously in the political system.
Yep. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. We'll have more with Scott Shepard. He's the deputy director of the National Center's Free Enterprise Project. Coming up, a former McDonald's CEO says companies have no business being in politics. We'll talk about that next. And welcome back. We're talking with Scott Shepard. He is the director of the National Center's Free Enterprise Project, launched in 2007. The Free Enterprise Project focuses on shareholder activism and the confluence of big government and big business. You can find out more by heading to nationalcenter.org. And so, Scott, with the Disney fiasco putting woke companies front and center in the news, you guys have been doing some very proactive work. And the New York Post recently ran a story about former McDonald's CEO Ed Renzi saying companies have no business being in politics, and said this, quote, corporations have no business being on the right or the left because they represent everybody there, and their sole job is to build equity for their investors. I mean, that is straight out of Milton Friedman, who said essentially the same thing. Ed Renzi has launched the Boardroom Initiative. This is a coalition with a mission to push back against U.S. corporations whose boardrooms are becoming too political and fighting woke corporate policies. So talk to us about the Boardroom Initiative, what that is, who else is involved, and how your organization, the Free Enterprise Project, got involved.
Yeah, so that is an organization, the founding members of which are us and Second Vote, which does some ranking of corporations for their leftism or sanity. and the Job Creators Network, which is an organization that works to, it's in the name, right? So it works to make markets work for small, particularly small entrepreneurs and smaller companies that really are the job creators in our system. And Ed Renzi, as you say, was the CEO of McDonald's. He's a great and really clever man who's committed to the idea that everybody should be able to work hard make themselves successful and take care of themselves and rise and reach the American dream. And so we've all come together to try to do some of what the left does so well, and that we're still catching up on. The left is really good at coalitions and organizing.
Yes.
And you'll notice how they all have the same talking point. Now, I don't want anybody to give me talking points. I'm not interested in that. But they're really good at running coalitions and pushing. We don't do that as well on the right because we're individuals. We're family-based. We're not looking for anybody else to tell us what to do. But this, our organization, the Boardroom Initiative, is an effort by our groups and hopefully eventually a much wider coalition of groups who come together to say enough of this push from the left. You've taken over higher ed. You've taken over Hollywood. You've taken over what used to be the news media. You're not taking over corporations. We're going to push back there. And then we're going to keep pushing until conservatives feel comfortable sharing their opinions and speaking their minds on college campuses, and conservatives can get college professorships, and conservatives can be conservative in Hollywood, and conservatives can be conservative in the civil service. We're going to push the counter march through the institutions until politics doesn't dictate one's ability to have a successful career or to be able to speak their minds. We've had enough, and so we're getting together to push back.
So we hear almost exclusively about these woke corporations, Disney and the like. And are there corporations on the opposite side of the spectrum that have gone too political?
That have gone too far right?
Yeah. I really can't think of
any. Oh, jeez. No. I'll tell you what. I would be having, you've heard of the Babylon Bee, of course. They had a parody story the other day about this rugged, or a couple of months ago now, but about this rugged conservative who said he's going to boycott all the lefty corporations. So he's living in a cave, cuddling a MyPillow, and has a box full of Goya, because that's it. That's it. It hasn't caved, at least to some extent. And that's really in large part our fault, because the left has been pushing and nagging and threatening and protesting and scaring. You remember Zuccotti Park and Occupy Wall Street and Eat the Rich? They've been scaring these people for decades, and they've been infiltrating. And we've only just recently caught on to what's been going on. You know, I taught law school for quite a while, even just down the road from you at Willamette. And I knew from being inside the higher ed that it had become impossible. I mean, I had to go. It was impossible to be a conservative and a law professor. You got driven out. Mm-hmm. But we let that happen to too many institutions in our country, and so we've just got to all fight back together.
Well, one of the things that your organization does really well is that you guys focus on shareholder value. And you look at something like what happened there in Florida with Disney deciding to fight Governor DeSantis's parents' rights bill regarding preventing sex ed curriculum being pushed down to kindergartners through third grade. I mean, that's just astounding that you're trying to shove sexuality at kindergartners to begin with. But you're talking shareholder value here as well, because that was their mainstay, Disney's. It was the family. Yep. It was reaching out to parents and getting those kids in the parks. And now they're coming out saying, we're going to shove all of this garbage at your kids. I mean, how did you guys go after Disney on that end of things?
Well, we at the shareholder meeting where Bob Chapek was scared into. Now, the background story of this, as I've heard it, is that Bob Chapek intended to just keep out of that. He understood what the bill said, and he understood that the activists were lying about the bill, as they are. Mm-hmm. The funny thing about the supposedly don't say gay bill is that it doesn't say gay or any synonym of gay anywhere in the bill. It just says don't talk about sex to kids who want to talk about dinosaurs and strangely enough, Frozen, the Disney film,
right?
But that's got to be over. So he got forced into. We went to that shareholder meeting. We had a proposal for Disney. We said, listen, There's lots of evidence that you're discriminating on the basis of race and sex and orientation. How about you conduct a study to make sure you're not violating anybody's civil rights so that we shareholders don't have to pay for your stupid? And they told us to stick that right in our ears.
Wow.
And then there was a lot of lefty protesters about the anti-grooming bill, lying about the anti-grooming bill, and he capitulated to them. And now he's lost the special tax status, and he's lost 20, 30, 40% of Disney's shareholder value. He not only has to go, but I would be stunned if there aren't shareholder derivative lawsuits suing him in his personal capacity.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, if that's the next step. So, okay, let's go and take a break. Come back, we're going to be talking about Twitter. Stay with us. More with Scott Shepard. He's the director of the Free Enterprise Project. And welcome back in our final segment now here on the iSpire Radio Show. We're talking with Scott Shepard. He is the director of the Free Enterprise Project, a program of the National Center for Public Policy Research. Absolutely great organization, and you can find out more about them by heading to nationalcenter.org. That's nationalcenter.org, and we'll link that up on iSpireRadio.com on today's show page. So, Scott, there is perhaps no bigger example of woke corporations than Twitter, which used to be a platform for people to share their opinions, and now it's more of a platform designed to shut down conservatives, which is kind of weird because Twitter said, oh, we don't censor conservatives, we don't shut them down. And then everyone at and on Twitter all freaked out when Musk made an offer to buy Twitter because they wouldn't be allowed to censor conservatives anymore. So that's a tad odd, isn't it?
Well, of course. But what they said was, well, we don't censor conservatives. We censor hate. Well, what's your definition of hate? Well, you know, people who want lower taxes or believe that we shouldn't discriminate now to make up for other discrimination in the past, or that people should be hired for merit. And they just go down the list, and it's every center-right, sensible.
Right.
Anything that everybody agreed on 5 years ago is now hate.
Yeah.
Well, so, you know,
exactly,
if you think that women should be able to have their own sports, you're a dirty hater, man.
Yeah. Yeah. We hate anyone who doesn't hate the stuff that we hate, which means you.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
So one of the funny things that happened soon after he made that offer and it was accepted by the board is suddenly tens of thousands of Twitter users magically disappeared. And the thought is that these weren't just people rage quitting Twitter, but it was actually a whole bunch of accounts that were ghost accounts, essentially, that somebody was controlling, not their own account and maybe a second, maybe anonymous account, but thousands of accounts being controlled by one people. And so that would seem to indicate when he made that proffer offer, that offer there, that they may have been lying about the number of users. If that turns out to be true, is he able to go back and say, yeah, instead of 46 million, we're going to do maybe 39 or billion, I mean?
Well, I was just I was just listening to an audio book about the beginning of the Second World War and the Japanese embassy on the 7th of December. The staff was out burning bales of papers before they got taken over. Mm. And the declaration of war occurred. And I suspect there's a lot of the digital version of that going on at Twitter.
Yeah.
A lot of digital bonfires in the back rooms of Twitter as they try to get rid of. But even whatever they do to disguise it, the fact that all of these users are disappearing, that the New York Times was pretended that the New York Times had vastly more users than it did. There are enough forensic skills. You know, if the New York Times went from 100,000 followers, I'm not on Twitter, so maybe these are the wrong numbers, but from 100,000 to 20,000 followers, and then you check somebody who genuinely had 100,000 followers and how many retweets they were getting a day, and the New York Times and its 20,000 followers, and if the retweets from the New York Times look more like a genuinely 20,000 follower account than a $100,000 follower account, then I think Elon has a chance to go and renegotiate or blow the whole thing up, and then Parag and his team would face almost an endless series of lawsuits. But also, I mean, if the New York Times was selling, if ad space was being sold connected to New York Times tweets and stuff, based on it supposedly having five times as many viewers and users as it and followers as it does, then it would seem to me that if the New York Times knew about that, then the Times should be sued by advertisers and all sorts of other people. So this could have an immense ripple effect.
Yeah.
And then, you know, no matter what they're trying to hide at Twitter, if it turns out that Dorsey or Parag or the others were lying to Congress when they said, oh, you know, we don't censor, we don't have algorithms to do X and Y, we weren't shadow banning, we weren't down, all those other tricks that they have. If that all turns out to be lies, you know, there could be a lot of people in jail.
Yeah,
which
this could be very entertaining.
I don't want to see anybody in jail, but gosh.
Oh, I do.
If they've earned it.
I do. I want to see them in jail. Absolutely. If they were lying to Congress, if they're lying to their shareholders, yeah, it's. I'm of the opinion people need to start going to jail over this sort of stuff, because otherwise it's just going to continue.
It'll be interesting to see in 2025.
Yeah, very much.
Just who ends up in the docket.
Yes. So, of course, this sale isn't final yet. Everybody is kind of assuming it's a done deal. The shareholders still have to approve it. What do you think on that? Do you think shareholders will vote to let the sale go through?
Well, I think that at this point, shareholders will recognize that if the sale doesn't go through, if it doesn't unwind, especially if the market continues the way it continued today, that Twitter's never going to be worth anything like that amount again. And so I think just from a bottom line, these Karens and Craigs like to run our lives, but they're not going to make themselves poor to do it. They want to make us poor, not them.
That's true. So, okay. Well, Scott, we've got lots more to ask you. We'll just have to have you back in order to do that. Scott Shepard, he is with the Free Enterprise Project. You can find out more by heading to nationalcenter.org. Scott, I want to thank you so much for your time today. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much, Mark. Anytime at all.
Next week, we will be bringing Jonathan E. Mord, one of America's top constitutional attorneys, back to the show. Last week, the news broke that the General Accounting Office of the federal government issued a report that found that the CDC, the FDA, and other agencies manipulated COVID data and used it for political purposes. And with the likely overturn of Roe v. Wade, there is going to be a lot to talk about next week. This is our last show before the primary. Get out there and vote. You've got a lot of power this year if you use it, which is what we say every week. The best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.